it dry. There was so much water, I couldn't believe my eyes. And I was worried about my family, will they be alright? Will they make it on the I-2 for another night? Oh, people thirsty, dying by the roadside. Oh, and jumping off the bridge, committing suicide. Babies crying, mama.
Many nations around the world have incorporated human rights provisions into their legal framework and now provide more basic rights to their people than the United States. In key instances, international human rights standards are broader and more protective than the U.S. Constitution or domestic civil rights laws. At this moment in history, the notion of applying a universal human rights framework to the United States seems to be striking a chord with activists around the country.
What do we want? Human rights!
Where do we want it?
Now!
I think human rights are important, especially for young people, because it shows how people that don't know their human rights are being violated every day. Young people should also get involved in the human rights because you don't have to be an adult to change the world.
To you, we speak the truth. To you, we speak the truth.
This is Ojamo Baraka, Executive Director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and you're listening to No Retreat, No,
no
Retreat,
Compromise,
No, no retreat, Compromise, No, no Compromise.
And we'd like to welcome our listeners for another podcast of the U.S. Human Rights Network. Today we're going to be having a very important discussion, talking about the possibilities that are in place as a consequence of the historic election that took place on November the 4th. We're going to be talking about how we continue to push the human rights framework and the kinds of spaces that might exist under a new administration, either Republican or a Democrat. We're then going to be talking with Catherine Powell, who is heading up an effort to reassert U.S. leadership in the field of human rights. They have produced, under the auspices of the American Constitution Society, a document that will be presented to either the Republicans or the Democrats. It is called Human Rights at Home, a Domestic Policy Blueprint for the New Administration. And she's going to talk about the motivation behind that document and what we should expect from a new administration in the field of human rights. And we're here for a very important discussion with Catherine Powell, who is a professor of law at Fordham University and who is heading up the process of writing and putting in place this very important paper. It's called Human Rights at Home, a Domestic Policy Blueprint for the new administration. Professor Powell, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's my
pleasure. Can you first share with our listeners the impetus for putting this paper together?
Well, the idea of putting the blueprint together was not only to put together a document that could help guide a new president and his administration, but also part of the goal, really, is to build a movement and a constituency. So the process involved reaching out to advocates like you, reaching out to former government officials and people working on the Sioux campaign, and scholars, reaching out to people in a variety of sectors to really build, develop some buy-in on what a new administration should be doing around returning human rights at home.
I guess it's important to note that this podcast will be broadcast after the election. So this process is a nonpartisan process and is a blueprint that is supposed to be geared toward whoever wins the election, correct?
That's right. For many decades, there's been a bipartisan commitment to human rights in this country, and it's important that that all political parties feel they can take ownership over this idea of human rights, because it's really at the root of this country. At least the principle of human rights is very much a part of who we are as Americans and who we say we are. And so the process then of outreach involves reaching out to people in the two major political parties, and our advisory group has both Democrats and Republicans, so that no matter who ends up in the White House, there's support across the spectrum.
So the idea is to get this blueprint into the hands of either administration, from either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, and to begin a dialogue with those transition personnel, correct?
That's right. And so the advisory group involves people who are, as I said, involved in the campaigns, and some of whom will be involved in the eventual transition, and so we'll be returning to those folks and handing the document off to them, working with advocates as a constituency to try to work from outside. So our plan is really to be working with people both on the inside and outside in partnership to make sure that we can find a way for the new administration to really affirm human rights at home.
Now, we know that those first 100 days are a very important period, and we know that there are a number of competing messages that any administration will be receiving from various sources. In the paper, you make the argument that it's really important for the U.S. to reestablish its leadership in the human rights field. What are some of the recommendations that the blueprint is pushing for the first 100 days?
Right. The first 100 days are critical, and we know there's heightened awareness around trying to address some of the abuses that have occurred over the last 8 years in the area of national security and human rights, shutting down Guantanamo, dealing with those kinds of issues. We're hoping that within the first 100 days, the new administration will look at human rights at home broadly, not only the national security issues, which are quite important, but looking at human rights broadly, including race equality, including gender equality, including issues of poverty. And so within the first 100 days, we're calling on the new administration to issue an executive order that would reconstitute or reestablish the a government working group that would coordinate all the different departments to be responsible for human rights in each of their areas, whether it's the Justice Department or the State Department or the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Each of these departments needs to incorporate human rights into their day-to-day work so that when the next Hurricane Katrina comes along, the government can respond in a human rights-friendly way around issues of education, that the government should respond in a human rights-friendly way. So our immediate goal is to have the new administration reestablish this interagency working group on human rights. A second recommendation is to have the administration set up a national human rights commission, which would be more of an independent body that the government would establish but would have some independence in the way the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. At one point, people saw the Commission on Civil Rights as the conscience of the nation in the 1960s. We'd like to see a National Human Rights Commission that could be the conscience of the nation, that could help to hold hearings, that could help to do field hearings and educational training sessions around the country, that could do investigations and fact-finding into human rights allegations around the country.
And what are some of the specific things that we could look for that can indicate that a new administration is, in fact, recommitting itself to human rights within those first 100 days, but beyond those two recommendations?
I think we should look to the inaugural address, and a new president really should say something about human rights and the importance of human rights, not only returning to our core values that were expressed in the American Declaration of Independence, the idea that human rights are inalienable, that we're all created equal, but that also in affirming this idea of human rights, it's restoring our leadership around the world. So we should look to the inaugural address. We should look to the State of the Union. I think these are very early tests for a new president and opportunities for a new president to strongly affirm the idea of human rights and the importance of applying human rights in our domestic policy as well as our foreign policy. Then we should also look to the president to act back up his words with action, concrete action. So in addition to saying something in one of these high-profile speeches, issuing an executive order to really implement human rights into the structure of government.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is going to be a very important period, and we know that for any administration, reestablishing its leadership role in this field is going to be important. It appears that there is an agreement among all of the political elites that relying on U.S. soft power is going to be a very important item in the next 4 years. We're saying that, does that then suggest then that human rights activists within the U.S. may have more leverage with an administration, either Republican or Democrat?
Yes, it's an excellent point, because I think increasingly with some of the limitations on our using extending our military power overseas. We see that you can't win a war, whether it be a war of ideas or a real war, solely through hard power. We fight, when we send our troops overseas, we're fighting to protect our ideas and our ideals. And so we have to stick by our ideals, even in tough times. And so as the war in Iraq has dragged on, we see the importance then of bolstering our principles, our human rights principles, because if we want to win support from people from around the world, and the new president has a tremendous opportunity to do that, we have to lead by example. We can't say that we want to spread democracy throughout the Middle East and then not practice human rights principles at home.
Mm-hmm. Do you see the possibility with this increased potential leverage on the part of human rights activists, do you see the possibility of a discussion taking place with any new administration that is primarily a discussion among the elites, with the thrust that has been coming from the bottom up for the last 10, 15 years, that effort will be de-emphasized in this new period? Do you see that possibility?
I think that with the record numbers of voter registration, and particularly with the enthusiasm that the Obama campaign has generated in reaching young people, that this election has really unleashed tremendous amounts of excitement about politics, about the potential for the country. And, I think a new government will have tremendous opportunity to create partnerships with civil society, and particularly with young people. And I think that's very exciting for the human rights movement.
So basically, no matter who wins, as a consequence of the kind of enthusiasm and greater participation on the part of people across the board, any administration will have to be more responsive to demands coming from the bottom up.
Any administration will have to be more responsive. I don't think we can turn back the clock.
I agree. Professor Powell, we really want to thank you for sharing this with us. We're going to make sure that this document is available to the public on our website, and we share your optimism that the clock can't be turned back, that this struggle for human rights is a struggle that cannot be turned back, and that we have marvelous opportunities in the next 4 years to push the struggle forward.
The next piece of audio you're going to hear is from Ejim Dike. This audio was recorded at the U.S. Human Rights Network National Conference that took place in 2008 in Chicago, Illinois. Ejim Dike is a human rights advocate at the Urban Justice Center in New York City.
Well, thank you very much. Again, my name is Ejim Dike, and I am going to talk about what we did in New York City, which was really a much smaller version of what happened on the national level. I work with the Human Rights Project at the Urban Justice Center, and we're a small advocacy group based in New York City, and our mission is to promote human rights, and perhaps more specifically, to promote the use of the human rights framework in social justice organizing. And we do this through human rights documentation, through outreach and education, as well as through legislative reform. Last year, I guess starting in May, we coordinated, mobilized over 30 New York City groups to participate in a New York City Stern Shadow Report. Now, we have some copies, not many, that we brought here. But yes, everyone has copies in front. Now, this was submitted as part of the U.S. Human Rights Network's national report, but we also submitted it as a separate report. And that was for specific reasons that I'll talk about later, because it was very important for us in our local organizing to have a separate document that we could focus on New York City that we could use in our work. Let's see. Now, the report, when the people who participated in this report spanned different issue areas. We had over 9 issue areas represented, and that also was very important because these are groups that don't typically work together or don't have many fora to work together that had come together to submit one specific thing. We have people working on education, employment, health, housing, criminal justice, perhaps newer to the discussion of race, domestic violence, and child welfare. We also talk about immigration reform, and that's something that's really important to remember when we talk about contemporary forms of racism, is that it includes immigration status and the experience of immigrants. We also discuss voting rights. And then we tried to look at, we didn't do this as successfully as we wanted to, but we tried to look at the intersections. So we looked at race, and then we looked at the additional discrimination people experience because of their gender identity, their immigration status, their sexual orientation, and their age. But of course, the problem you always run into is data. So we did it to the best of our ability and to how time allowed. Most groups that participated in the New York City Shadow Report were new to the process, and this was really great for us because it was a tool. It was a tool for recruiting new people to the human rights movement. And most people who participated were really excited about the possibility of taking their case to a higher court, and in this case, it's the higher court of the United Nations, the global community of human rights. And this is really important because, as was mentioned earlier in the plenary, sometimes we have laws here that are in fact the enemy because the laws themselves are unjust. And when what you're fighting against is actually the legal system, you have to go above it. And so for many of the activists we were working with, they had been bumping up against the law for so long, it was really a refreshing opportunity to go above that. Now, I've been asked to address 3 things, so I will try to focus on that. One is, why was this process important to us? And it was important to us for 2 reasons. One, it was an opportunity for us to document across a range of issues racial discrimination that's occurring in New York City, and also to link that discrimination to specific city policies and practices, either directly or indirectly. And this is really important because we live in a world today where, I don't know if it's delusion or what, but most policymakers, and I would even argue most of the general public, think that discrimination is a thing of the past. And in fact, what has happened is that discrimination has become so widespread that it's become normal. We don't question discrimination anymore. So it's invisible. In fact, when we talk to policymakers, the first question that always comes up is people want proof that this is not, that we're not talking about individual instances of discrimination, but structural discrimination. Because I think policymakers have convinced themselves that actually systemic discrimination is no longer an issue. This is just a few bad apples. And so for us, it was really important to have in one place documentation that actually, no, this is a systemic problem. It's linked to government policies. And even more importantly, there's something that you can do about it. And that it's in violation of human rights law. So, and this is something that we're going to, we see ourselves and we have already started using in local advocacy. The other reason why it was important for us is that as an organization that tries to convince, I guess, groups, social justice groups, that the human rights framework is of use in their work, that this is something that they can find useful in meeting the immediate needs of the people they work with, their constituents, this provided us with a concrete opportunity. Typically, the people we work with are trying to meet people's immediate problems. So people don't have time necessarily to be talking about some human rights law that's somewhere that is not even applicable in our courts for the most part. But here we had, an organizing opportunity, but also we had a concrete mechanism for people to engage. And to have, they had an outcome that would come out in a short period of time. There was also the possibility of going to Geneva to take the case there. So it was really exciting for people, and it was a great opportunity for us, and I think for the whole human rights community in general. And in fact, since then, talk about the special rapporteur. I've had people asking me, calling me, when is the special rapporteur coming to the United States? You know, people, it's generated so much interest in the human rights framework. When we've done report backs, people have come to me to talk about, you know, their specific campaigns and how they might be able to engage the UN in fighting it. So it really is helping build this human rights movement. Let's see. So then the other question is, what was the most significant impact of Geneva for us? Like I said, most of us, including myself, it was the first time I'd gone to a CERT process, well, there'd only been one before. So most people were new to that process. It was really reaffirming to see the importance of NGO participation in this process. And it just confirmed what we've been saying, that the use of the human rights framework is only as strong as we make it. And thanks to the network, thanks to the funders, the numbers that we were able to take to Geneva had a visible, huge impact. I mean, it was really exciting. First of all, you could see that the U.S. delegation was really flustered. They did not expect to see so many people there in the room. The room was packed. Second of all, the CERT committee, and this is even more important, the CERT committee members themselves, they were really excited by our presence, and they were informed by our presence. So they asked really pointed, informed questions that, and follow-up questions. And so when the U.S. government, our delegation, answered with nonsense, they were able to come back with information. Because we were there, we were prepared that we could inform them. So that, to me, was really the most significant impact of being in Geneva. Now, like I said, it was also because so many people were new to the process, and even new to human rights, period, it generated a lot of excitement and it laid the groundwork for future organizing. So now, many of the people who are new are talking about preparing for the special rapporteur's visit. People are talking about going to the Durban Review Conference and participating in the conference, period. And that is only good for the U.S. human rights movement. And then finally, it helped us get media attention locally. It's very difficult, anyone who knows, and especially in the New York City competitive media market, it's very difficult to get media attention. And to get media attention covering human rights issues and calling them human rights issues is almost impossible. But the novelty of going to Geneva made it so that we could get media attention. Even for the small New York City effort, we got media attention, your mainstream media talking about the fact that we went there and talking about it as a human rights issue. Okay, so unfortunately, I'm going to have to cut the rest of this short because this is the most important part, which is what we are doing for follow-up. Okay, I'm going to say real quickly. One of the things that we have been working on pre-Geneva for a long time, actually, is we're trying to get a piece of legislation passed in New York City that's based on CERT, as well as a sister treaty called CEDA, which is a women's treaty. And this has only served to renew energy around it. We just reintroduced the legislation in March. And in fact, having the shadow report is going to be invaluable. Because here we have, when people ask what is the problem, we have it. That's, you know, enough said. And then the second thing is that because we have this experience, because we are now armed with the information, with the language, with the mechanism, we're planning for the mayoral and the city council elections that are not happening in 08, but in 09. We have to lay the groundwork now. And so we've already started meeting and coming together to lay the groundwork so that we can hold the city elected officials accountable in 09. And one last thing that I want to say is that for us in New York City, over half of our city council members are term limited out. So this is really an opportunity to educate people who are planning to run for office. And then, in closing, I just want to say that, and I think this was the most important lesson. At the end of the day, this process is really as strong as we make it. We're the ones responsible for making the change that we want to see, as they say. So let's get to it. Thanks.
Underlying all human rights work in the United States is a commitment to challenge a belief that the United States is inherently superior to other countries of the world, and that neither the U.S. government nor the U.S. rights movement have anything to gain from the domestic application of human rights. Network members believe that the U.S. government should no longer be allowed to shield itself from accountability to human rights norms, and that the U.S. civil, disability, women's, workers, immigrant, LGBTQ, prisoner impunity, and other rights movements that stand to benefit perhaps now more than ever from an end to U.S. impunity in this regard. For more information on how to join the U.S. Human Rights Network, visit us online at www.ushrnetwork.org. Human Rights No Retreat, No Compromise podcast is a production of the U.S. Human Rights Network produced by Ajamu Baraka, Sunyata Altenor, and Genevieve Williams, with Sugar Matthews, Tanya Williams, Drina Brown, Kalia Kunu, and Rachel Fowler. U.S. Human Rights Network at www.ushrnetwork.org.
In its wake, Katrina left a ravaged Gulf Coast and a nation shocked by the images of poverty and neglect that it revealed.
To the extent that the federal government didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility. And it was so